Well, I'm out of time again. This concludes the first in our endocrine series, but you can revisit these show podcasts anytime on the Goldman Trip website. Meanwhile, thanks so much for your attention to Your Health with Dr. Kim Tripp. Remember, you can email your comments and suggestions to yourhealth@robinhoodradio.com. And if you have a health issue yourself and would like to find out about how we might be able to help you in our practice of traditional osteopathy, we're at our offices in Sharon, Connecticut, Dr. Kim Tripp and Dr. Andrew Goldman, Goldman Tripp Osteopathic Healthcare, 860-364-5990, with evening hours Wednesdays and Fridays, or on the web at www.goldmantripp.net. I'll be looking forward to being with you next time. Till then, you take care of yourself, enjoy your health, and thanks for listening.
Programming and underwriting support from William Jackson Fine Arts Storage, 60 North Main Street, Kent, a 10,000 square foot fine arts storage warehouse. White glove services by professional art handlers and shippers. Temperature controlled and climate controlled storage available to collectors, estates, and artists with private viewing room, loading dock, and transportation. For more information, 860-927-4501 or info@williamjacksonstorage.com. Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall. There's lots of us theatergoers who've had lifelong love affairs with the theater, but also have had normal jobs, perhaps dreaming what really being in the theater would be like someday. Well, my guest today made that leap from a career in the business world to becoming a new and already very accomplished playwright. My guest is Donald Loftus, who spent over 30 years in the fragrance industry with international firms from Yves Saint Laurent and Estee Lauder to Procter & Gamble. All the while, he was an avid theatergoer and part-time playwright, developing his craft and getting some plays read here and there. Now, he's churning out plays full-time and recently won the prestigious W. Keith Hedrick National Playwriting Award for 2019. And his plays are being staged all across America and the UK. In our very own area, his one act, Eddie and Edna, was performed in the 10x10 Festival at Barrington Stage in Pittsfield last winter. And his short play, Dark Matter, was performed at Theatre Works in New Milford and will have been performed at the One Act Play Festival at Sharon Playhouse on November 2. And his play, Springvale Armadillo, will be performed next spring at the Showcase Theatre in Hudson, New York. Welcome, Donald.
Thank you.
You get around.
I do.
Well, before we start talking about playwriting and your playwriting and how you made that happen, I just want to say how we met. It's due to Facebook. You have an incredibly large following on Facebook of loads of Facebook friends, okay, in quotation marks. And we had this common interest in theater. And one day we said, well, we have to get together. So we had, I think, a lunch or a coffee or something in Manhattan about a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we yakked about all things theater. So I just mentioned that maybe to explain the familiarity that we have with each other in this interview, but also to say Zuckerberg has made some terrible decisions about Facebook, and we know a lot of things wrong with it, but
yes.
Sometimes Facebook friends can become real friends.
That's
there
right.
You go.
That's right.
Who knew? Anyway, you've had a great career doing loads of stuff in the international fragrance industry, but when did you know that you had a theater bug that you had to do something with?
Actually, when I was 16,
okay.
Long before I got into the cosmetic business. I grew up in Cleveland, and we actually had more theaters per capita, allegedly, than New York City. We had lots and lots of theaters, and I used to do a lot of theater starting at 16. I came to New York with a school trip, fell in love with, I saw four shows that trip, and like they were yesterday, I remember them, and came back to Cleveland and performed in a lot of stuff. And even when I became a vice president, I was in retailing at the time, I became a vice president of the May Company, I never told anybody that I was actually doing that, because I thought they would think, you know, I wasn't serious about my career. How sad is that? But I would do like four shows a year. And growing up in Cleveland, one of my best friends was Mark O'Donnell, who wrote Hairspray. And we used to write shows together. And we used to actually tape them on audio tapes. And through our whole junior high and high school era, we would write shows then. So I've never not been involved, but my career, and I don't regret it, my career actually blossomed much better than I could have imagined, and I had a number of great jobs, and now I've retired and can really focus on my first passion.
You've been a lifelong and very supportive member of the Dramatists Guild. In fact, you got its prestigious Patrons Award back in 2013. But during those years when you were writing part-time but working in the industry, in the fragrance industry, retail industry, did you take classes? How did you professionally develop your craft?
I've always belonged to – there's a number of groups. In fact, I run one now, but there's a number of groups. My first one was called Stage Rights, and we met once a week, and it was a group of playwrights and a group of actors, and they read 10 to 12 pages of your play each week, and then the room discusses it. And now I belong to two others. One, like I said, that I run on a Tuesday night called Pages, and I also belong to one that's part of the Dramatists Guild. But like you, not nearly as often as you, but I go to see a lot of theater. And when you're a playwright or a would-be playwright, you don't just go and sit and take in the show.
Hello, John. If we're having a little technical difficulty here, I don't mean to talk over you if you're still talking to me, but we've suddenly lost the connection. So I'm just going to keep talking while our engineer Marshall Miles figures that out. One of the things that I do want to ask Donald when he gets back, and he's talking about going to the theater a lot, and then his first trip to New York when he was 16 years old from Cleveland, he saw four shows. I'm fascinated at which. For anybody involved in the theater, what was the first show that they saw when they came to New York and their first Broadway show? For mine, I came to New York as part of the high school debating club back in 1969, or was it 68? And it was at the last. It was in the last stage of the very long run of Hello, Dolly, and the debate coach made arrangements for us to get tickets to see Hello, Dolly, and it was with Ethel Merman. So that was the first Broadway play that I saw. Are we back together again, Donald? You there?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know if you heard all of that vamping while I
didn't hear anything. No, I'm so sorry.
Okay, so let's get back on track. Just to bring this full circle, you mentioned and then we'll talk about playwriting. When you first came to New York, when you were 16 years old from Cleveland, you saw four shows that trip. What was the first Broadway play of those that you saw?
Mame.
Well, yeah. That'll do it to you.
Yeah. And I remember Jane Morgan, we were like the 15th Mame or something, and Jane Morgan, who was a big band singer, was playing Mame. Well, I'd never been to New York. I'd never been to Broadway. It happened my birthday. And she walked out, and I just thought she was the most beautiful thing ever. And I thought the show was just amazing. And the next day, Rex Reed wrote in the newspaper, "The only way to shut Jane Morgan up is to drive a stake through her heart." And I was, like, devastated. And that was the first time I realized how rough critics could be. But the trip was amazing, and it changed my life, really.
Okay, so you're still going to the plays all the time, and you're a playwright. So you know your craft. You know how to structure a play. You know how to write dialogue. You know how to develop characters. You know how to create an arc. You know how to create conflict and all this. When you go to a play and it's really bad, Can you immediately know where the playwright went wrong?
Yes, I think so. I think it's structurally for sure, and I can't help myself, but because I sit there and I analyze every single line of dialogue and so on. And I also sometimes I'm surprised where a show is a hit, And yet it's just filled with, in my opinion, problems, which, you know, my wife finds very arrogant that I even think that. But, you know, where, you know, I just think it goes way off the rails, and yet the audience doesn't seem to mind. So it's interesting. And I think it's important that, as a playwright, we understand what the audience is up for, you know, and what they're willing to take. And that varies from region to region, frankly. So, you know, depending on what you're writing, you've got to be, you know, conscious of that as well.
But when does your writing, you're talking about how sometimes, you know, a bad play can become, something that's bad on paper can become a really good play. When right. does the nature of theater, okay, and what's the magic that's up there on the stage really transcend, even if it's great writing, what the playwrights put on paper?
I think, you know, I think any play that changes somebody, where they leave the theater as a different person than they entered, even if it's not the entire audience, if it moves somebody in the audience, the play to me has done its job and mm-hmm. has been successful. I mean, I think, you know, theater is really transformative, and it should move us. Even you know, like comedies. I mean, I think it should. To me, that's when a play is successful, when it's not just an entertainment that we're, you know, sort of enjoying, but we actually we feel differently about being a human being, I guess, than we did when at the beginning of the play.
Right. So in your retirement, you knew a lot of people. You didn't start from ground zero. You member the active member of the Dramatists Guild, lived
right.
in New York
on the
a
board,
long time.
Actually, of the foundation.
Right. You know a lot of people in the theater. You've been practicing your craft for a long time. But still, you had to go on a deliberate and concerted effort to market yourself, to get your plays, your one acts, staged in different festivals around the country in the UK. How did you go about that?
Well, there's a number of sources, and I know that some of them have mentioned on your show in the past. NewYorkPlaywrights.com is a great source. They post every day, you know, opportunities around the country. There's a thing called Playwright Submission Helper, which I find hugely useful. And to give you an idea, and I think one of the advantages I have, frankly, over some of my other playwright friends is that because of my business background, I'm like super diligent. I'm like, you know, incredibly driven and anal about it, I guess. So since in the two years since I've been retired from the cosmetic business, I've submitted over 1,000 plays, not all different plays, but 1,000 submissions across the country and in English-speaking countries like England and Australia and so on. And from that, and I thought when I started doing it, I thought, you know, if one or two theaters pick this up, I'll be thrilled. And in fact, in that time, I've had like 35 productions, which, you know, and some are short, like the Barrington play, and then some of them are full lengths, like the Spring Bale Armadillo that you mentioned coming in spring, or I just had one in Mesa, Arizona, that was a full length called Pear. And so it's. You need to be aggressive about sending them out. You need to be diligent and have you know, some rules about, you know, what you want to accomplish each day. You need to have goals. It's not a casual thing. It's a lot of work.
Right. But besides your kinetic intellect and plainly being probably a very fast typist and and a deep well of curiosity, where do you get your ideas to write a play? I don't want to bastardize this, but I think it was Pinter who once said, just sit down with a concept and it will follow. And he said one of his most famous plays, I started out, as he said at one point, just picturing two people on a park bench. And what are they doing there? What's their backstory to get there? Does that kind of thing work in your head too?
It's funny because you mentioned my Facebook. So one of the things I do, and that's a big inspiration for me actually, stories that I do a thing on Facebook where I do obscure facts of the day.
Things I love that. I love those history. Little that series.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And from that, it actually Pear, which is about a murder that took place at the turn of the century in Sweden, that came out of one of those stories. I was sort of fascinated with this thing I discovered that happened that day in history, and then I went back and investigated, and there was a huge, you know, backstory on the whole thing, and that became a full-length play. A lot of it's that. A lot of it is sometimes it's experiences that I've had. I just had one called Dress Blues that was actually an experience I had with a friend of mine who was a woman who was in a dress shop, and she was really trying on things that were just not appropriate for her. And there was a salesman there, the manager, who was hysterical in his comments. And so that became a short play on the importance of, you know, being true to ourselves. And so the inspirations can come from anywhere. And I find that, and this is probably not normal, but I find that there are days where I want to write a comedy, you know, and I want to work on a comedy. I have about 35 plays in various stages of development that, have, you know, over the years have been in my computer. Some are very heavy dramas. Some are very personal and, you know, biographical, I guess. And then some are just, you know, silly little, you know, things. And depending on what I want to work on that particular day, I pull it up and I work on it, you know. And the goal is to, you know, keep driving them to their completion. And I have about, I have three musicals that I've written the book and lyrics that are done and have had readings and so on. And I have about 12 one-act plays and about four full lengths. And then I have a ton of stuff in the works, you know.
I think we can describe you as productive.
Yeah, super productive.
Super productive.
They may not all be gems, but hopefully there's a couple there that, you know, that go on to do something good.
In case you're just joining us, the program's Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. My guest is Donna Loftus. Donna Loftus had a wonderful career in the cosmetics industry. He was always involved in theater writing as sort of a hobby, but he's doing it full-time to prove that there is life after retirement in a most productive way. Two of the plays that are coming into this area or have been here already are Dark Matter, which you submitted to the TheaterWorks one-act play festival. That's going to be done also at Sharon Playhouse on November 2nd for those who can get there between hearing this live and may well have seen it after the program is rebroadcast later. And then also up at Great Barrington last year, you did a play called Eddie and Edna. And these are 10-minute plays, I think, both.
Yes.
Eddie and Edna really captivated me. Can you set it up?
You were very kind in the review, Dan. You were very kind to me.
Well, I don't think I was being – I really am not really – being kind does not slip off my lips very easily. So I think I was just being candid. It was really good. Could you just set it up first briefly so we can talk about the dynamics of putting all of that in 10 minutes?
That was actually inspired by sort of an autobiographical thing. My mother had Alzheimer's and unfortunately died of it. And this was about – a man who really can't distinguish what's, you know, reality from what from, you know, what's in his imagination, and his in the play, we sort of approach it from his mind. So you, as the audience member, are not quite sure: is the wife really there? Is he imagining her? Is she dead? And there's a son that appears that is also sort of mysterious, and so it's just the, you know, the frustration of when that happens to somebody and how difficult it is to get through all that and the impact that it has on the family members.
Well, in 10 minutes, though, what you really achieve is what theater's about, which is the ambiguity of is of reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, I was pretty astounded by that. How difficult is it? I know you're a quick thinker and writer, obviously, but how difficult is it to put three characters, conflict, ambiguity, theme, tension, and theatrics, and get that done for a 10-minute performance?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, I actually love the challenge of it. And some people, you know, there's a difference between a 10-minute play and a skit. You know, what Saturday Night Live does, and God love them, I love Saturday Night Live, but those are skits for the most part. A 10-minute play, you know, usually the protagonist has to go through something, you know, is met with, as you say, met with a conflict and has to either overcome the conflict or not. But at the end of the play, they've been through a journey, and they're different at the end. And that's really what makes a play versus a skit. So that is, it's like cross, you know, I know Sondheim's a big, you know, crossword puzzle freak. I think it's that sort of thing. It's like it's a challenge to make sure that you're not writing a skit, because that's not what we're supposed to be doing. We're, you know, we want it in theater. We want to have a true play, and I do enjoy that challenge.
And Dark Matter, which was at TheaterWorks and is going to be at Sharon, or will have been at Sharon Playhouse, can you set that up for us a little bit?
Yeah, so that is, it appears that this couple is just having a difficult moment in their marriage. They've been married a long time, and she's a bit annoyed at him, and you just think it's a normal situation. It turns out they're actually in outer space, mm-hmm. and they're on a, and they're they've left Earth, and they at some point lived on Mars, but now they're living somewhere with these beings who are really just out to learn everything that they know, and they've drugged him, and she's not on the drug. It's a very strange thing. It's sort of a cross between Noel Coward and The Twilight Zone is what I was going for. So the dialogue is sort of Noel Coward-y, because I wanted you not to know that they were in outer space, but the plot line is sort of
And this
Twilight.
Is all, again, in 7 or 8, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. And then looking forward to May at the Showcase Theater in Hudson. Springvale Armadillo, you mentioned that's one of your full plays.
Yeah, that's probably, so far of what I've completed, I think that's probably my best work.
Uh-huh.
It's a drama, and it's about it takes place in the 80s. It's actually based on a true story, or somewhat true. There was actually a scare of leprosy in America back in the 20s, and it was particularly embarrassing in the southern states, the Bible Belt, if you will, because of the whole relationship between leprosy and sin. So if you were rich enough and somebody in your family was suspected of having it, you were sent to Carville, as in the political man Carville.
Mm-hmm.
There was a hospital called Carville. I've changed that hospital to be Springvale. And in this character, the 17-year-old debutante, they see something on her shoulder. They're afraid she has it. They send her here. 80 years have passed. She's in her 80s. And now a young man from Boston who's a reporter for the Globe has come to interview her to find out how she survived this. They're closing the hospital. They want to sell the property to a shopping center. But they have these, and leprosy has been curable since the 80s, but they have these, you know, octogenarians who are still there, and they don't know what to do with them. Because when you go there, when you were sent there, your name was changed. No one was allowed to visit you, and you basically were just sent there to be forgotten. And so this young man, who turns out his lover, has recently died of AIDS, and now he's sort of facing the same thing that she did. You know, is he going to be HIV positive? Is this going to happen? How do you survive the not knowing of all that? It sounds very heavy, and it is.
Yeah.
But it's and through the interviews that he has with her every day under her tree, she sits under this weeping willow tree, a young version of her comes out, and she begins the story, and then a young version of her comes out and completes the story. And the reporter becomes the young man of her life, you know.
Mm-hmm. How many characters?
It's three characters.
Wow. That's going to be in May at Showcase Theater in Hudson.
Right, and that's the one that just won the award. It actually had won an earlier version of it, had won an award years ago when I was still in the cosmetic business. It had won an award in California,
mm-hmm.
and I've since tightened it and rewritten it. But I think it's probably my best work so far.
Good. You've talked a lot about your original works. Do you attempt it to, or have you done many adaptations of classic or playwrights that we all know? Or do you...
Musical version. We've done musicals that are sort of. So we did a musical version of Pollyanna,
mm-hmm.
I can't believe nobody's ever done. I mean, I guess there have been productions of it, but there's never been, you know, one that went on.
Don't give Disney any more ideas than they have already.
I know, but it went into public domain, and it was funny because when we did an Equity stage reading of it, Disney actually sent some people, and we thought, oh, God, this is great. Maybe they're going to, you know, but they were really looking to make sure that their property was protected.
Of course.
Because Disney took the novel and totally changed it. So we were very, very careful to stick to the original novel, which was in public domain. Obviously, the Disney script was not. So we stuck to the novel, and it was very good. It's very, very hard to sell musicals. And like I say, I have three that are done, but it's even for, you know, on the board of the Dramatists Guild, there are, you know, obviously we have a lot of very successful people from Broadway musicals, and they tell me it's impossible to get anything produced. So I've sort of backed off that now. But anyway, that was one that was based on a classic. We also did a novel based on the Betty Davis movie where she plays Apple Annie.
Can't remember that. Oh, the...
Pocketful of Miracles.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, that actually, and Anita Gillette actually played Annie for us, and she was fabulous in it. And the problem with that one was that it's written by the same playwright who wrote, or novelist who wrote the book for Guys and Dolls, you know, the original concept for Guys and Dolls. And so this too is Gangsters and Showgirls, and it's
that would
very
be Dashiell
hard
Hammer,
not to
wasn't
be compared
it?
To Guys and Dolls.
No.
So we finally just walked away
not
from
Dashiell
it.
Not
Dashiell
Hammer, anyway.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who that would be, and I think I know, but I don't. You've had a lot of readings, a lot of workshops of your plays. For the first time, you hear other people acting or speaking or reading the words that you've written. Does it sometimes startle you, shock you?
Yes.
Do you say, well, I wrote that, but I didn't mean it that way?
No,
how do you deal with that?
For instance, you mentioned the Barrington stage. So, you know, I had heard Eddie and Ed read a number of times and in a number of different theaters and, you know, and so and some of my workshops and whatever. But this one was directed by Matthew Penn, who had just directed Glenn Close at the Public Theater. He's Arthur Penn's son. He's an incredible director. Barrington Stage is such a professional group, and the actors, as you wrote, were really outstanding. I'm sitting there going, God, who wrote this? It was like hearing it for the first time. When that happens, that's wonderful. I had a very similar situation when I heard Pear. I went out to Mesa, Arizona to see the production of Pear. And they did such a wonderful job with it, I almost forgot that I wrote it. There are other times where you're going like, oh, my God, what was I thinking? You know, where it's just, you know, until you hear it aloud, you really don't know what you have, you know. And a production and the specific actors or the directors have such an impact on the work that it can change it completely. You know, the words can remain exactly the same, but depending on who's delivering them and who's directed them to deliver them, it can change everything.
Before I forget, I was muttering Dashiell Hammer, and you're talking about Guys and Dolls. I don't know
yes.
why I was thinking of him. Is Damon Runyon.
Damon Runyon.
There you go.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I think we've
he's a wonderful source, by the way.
Yeah. What time for a final question? What's sort of going through your head now in terms of something weird that you're thinking of that you've never done before that you want to do before it's too late?
Right now, I'm writing a very I'm right in the middle of a very heavy drama about which is very autobiographical. It's probably the one I've worked on the longest. It's about a father and son. Mm-hmm. I had a very difficult childhood. I won't go into all that right now, but it's about a father who's very, very ill, and he brings his son back to Ohio, actually, to photograph his death. And it's based on a series of Richard Avedon photographs, where Richard Avedon actually—I don't know if you ever have seen these, but
yeah.
Richard Avedon took like 8 photographs of his father.
Mm-hmm.
Each day, it was a different face that mm-hmm. was looking back at
yeah.
him as the man got closer and closer. And then at the end, it got more peaceful. And then the final photograph is his eyes are closed. It's so creepy, but it's brilliant. And from that inspired me to write this play. Which is a lot autobiographical. I mean, my father didn't actually ask me to do that, but that's what I'm really trying to finish now, and I've been working on it for years.
Right.
They say your best play will be the one that's closest to your real life, and this is that.
Well, we're going to look forward to it. I want to thank you for joining us, Donald. Great talking to you again. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Take care.
Okay. And thank you for listening to us. The program's Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. If you like what you hear on this program, go to robinhoodradio.com. Go to the support page and please express your appreciation where listeners supported. Until the next time you join us, stay healthy, be well, have fun.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.